You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Last week, the Bonneville Power Administration abruptly announced it was cutting funding to a state fisheries program that, among other things, helps support gillnetting on Oregon's north coast. Katie Frankowitz reports.
The Lower Columbia River's Select Area Fisheries Enhancement Program, or SAFE, raises millions of salmon in hatcheries on the lower river each year. The state says the SAFE program aims to increase salmon and steelhead for fishing and decrease harm on fish that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. The program has a long history of support from BPA. Now the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife says the loss of an estimated $2.4 million in funding could impact commercial and recreational fishing going forward. It could also mean impacts on associated county programs, including net pens in the Young's Bay Estuary, where juvenile salmon are reared and then released. In a letter to state fishery managers explaining the reason for the cut, BPA said the SAFE program hasn't shown it can reduce impacts on listed salmon stocks, the fish harmed by the federal dams BPA owns and operates. However, a spokesperson for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife argued the SAFE program is an integral component in the response to impacts of the federal Columbia River power system on fish and fisheries. The state maintains that BPA continues to have an obligation to fund the SAFE program as a result. According to the spokesperson, the state will be assessing all of its options, including legal implications of this change in direction. An Oregon appeals court has overturned Robert Keegan's manslaughter conviction for the fatal shooting of a Black Ashland resident in 2020. Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports.
Keegan was sentenced to 10 years in prison after killing Aiden Ellison in a hotel parking lot after a fight over loud music. This month, the judge ruled state prosecutors had wrongly instructed jurors on the limits to self-defense during that 2023 trial. Samantha Olson is with the Jackson County District Attorney's Office.
So we're basically starting over. Ultimately, it will likely end in us having to retry the case. So a brand new trial.
The shooting happened at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement. It was seen by some as a symptom of racism in majority white Ashland. Keegan cannot be prosecuted for murder again because a jury acquitted him of that charge. He'll face manslaughter in the first degree. His pretrial meeting is on July 6. A judge has set his bail at $500,000. I'm Justin Higginbottom in Ashland.
When Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's Prosperity Council releases its final report tomorrow, it's almost certain the panel will recommend an overhaul of the state's Economic Development Agency. The Prosperity Council was created with the goal of rebuilding Business Oregon. The agency has been widely criticized for making unpopular financial decisions and falling well behind other states in metrics of employment and business retention. According to a confidential draft of the council's report acquired by Oregon Journalism Project, the Prosperity Council describes Business Oregon as underperforming and calls out the agency's lack of responsiveness and limited ability to influence peer agencies. The report concludes that Oregon, quote, lacks a coordinated, comprehensive statewide economic development strategy, pointing directly at the agency charged with providing such a strategy. In the draft, the Prosperity Council recommends strengthening the agency and renaming it the Department of Commerce. The council's report will also likely shine a light on Business Oregon's director, Soporn Jang. Business leaders and lawmakers on background question whether Jang has the relevant experience to hold the position. Business Oregon spokesman Nathan Bueller says Jang's critics are wrong and that Jang has proven her abilities to run a complex agency with a complex budget. Kotek's council will unveil its final recommendations tomorrow. This story comes to us through a news partnership with Oregon Journalism Project and was reported on by Nigel J. Quiss, online at OregonJournalismProject.org. This spring, the Oregon coast had a visit from one of the world's most famous boats, the Western Flyer. KLCC's Brianna Bowman reports.
It all started more than 80 years ago. Sherry Flummerfelt tells the story.
In 1940, author John Steinbeck and his best friend, the marine biologist Ed Ricketts, chartered the Western Flyer for a six-week marine science collecting expedition in Mexico's Gulf of California, otherwise known as the Sea of Cortez.
Flummerfelt is the executive director of the Western Flyer Foundation, and she told this story because of the boat's lasting significance to marine science and literature.
It was a really important study at the time, but what made it really unique is that you had this storyteller on board.
Steinbeck would go on to publish a book about the research adventure called The Log from the Sea of Cortez. The vessel was recently restored to its former glory and is now used for both research and community outreach.
Had anyone heard of the Western Flyer before today?
I haven't heard of it, I've seen it.
You'd seen it before.
In 2024, the Flyer made its first modern expedition south from its California home, recreating Steinbeck and Ricketts' trip. This year, the Flyer made its way north and stopped at ports in Oregon and Washington along the way. Jack Barth is a professor at Oregon State University and a board member of the foundation. He says in a way they still recreate a partnership between scientists and artists.
This is a mixture of scientists, engineers, historians, writers, environmental scientists, this sort of Steinbeck-Ricketts mix of young people.
Newport resident Paul Tate, a fisherman with a long and storied career, knew of the Western Flyer for decades. He says he pinches himself now that he's the captain of the famous vessel.
She's a perfect boat, and doing what she was meant to be all those years, and that never would have happened without everybody contributing so much. And so I see the boat as a completion of everybody's dreams and thoughts and work.
The foundation's website says the Flyer is now heading home to Moss Landing. I'm Brianna Bowman reporting.
The fashion industry is one of the planet's biggest polluters, churning out mountains of waste while wreaking havoc on the environment. In the U.S. alone, more than 11 million tons of discarded clothing pile up every year. But here in Oregon, one charitable nonprofit is intercepting that waste stream, one clothing piece at a time. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert reports.
St. Vincent de Paul employee Wendy Chand is standing before a big pile of men's shirts.
I am currently hanging the clothes that we sorted that are good enough condition to send into the stores.
We're in a clothing warehouse on Seneca Road in West Eugene. It's a sprawling space with lines of tables stacked 6 feet high with every kind of clothing imaginable. Forklifts buzz around, loading and unloading. This is the epicenter of a major recycling operation in the Willamette Valley that aims to combat fast fashion waste. Fast fashion is clothing that is cheaply made and quickly produced to follow the latest trends. Consumers are encouraged to buy more and discard faster. Research shows fast fashion pollutes waterways, releases greenhouse gases, and spreads microplastics. But here in Oregon, St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County has been recognized as one of the region's largest fabric and textile recyclers. In fact, last year alone, the nonprofit diverted nearly 3 million pounds of these materials from landfills. And they're a major job creator. Network-wide, nearly 600 people are employed in homeless services, mattress recycling, thrift stores, and this warehouse. It all starts when clothing donations from around the state are delivered right here.
We take it, we process it, it gets dumped onto large tables. I have 20 clothing sorters, and they start by sorting through the clothes, and it gets sorted in different ways.
That's Brandy Carter, St. Vinny's clothing warehouse manager.
My crew, their job is to search for good quality clothing.
Carter says the goal for each employee is to sort out 500 pieces per shift.
No rips, no stains, no tears. And then we sort it, hang it, and get it into the store so that we can fill up the racks.
The clothing sorted by size, hung, tagged, and put into the shipping boxes. They'll later be sold off the racks at 14 stores throughout Oregon. Carter says they try to get use out of every stitch of donated clothing.
We sort out cotton t-shirts. If they have stains, rips, or tears on them, then they go for the bag of rags. All different kinds of companies like to buy them to use them as rags.
Shelly Sovins is sliding material into a cutting machine to make 12 by 12 inch squares.
Well, I worked here for 25 years, and then I got sick, so I was off for 4 years, and I've been back for almost a year now.
I love my job. Many of the individuals working in this warehouse and across the St. Vinny's network are part of a supported work experience program. Chalisa Hernandez manages this aspect of St. Vinny's operations in Lane County.
What sets us apart at St. Vincent de Paul is that we are a second chance employer. This plan is appropriate when a participant has little to no work history or experience.
Hernandez herself worked her way up to management in this way. Back at the warehouse, when sorters come across distressed clothing, they don't automatically discard it. Instead, they direct those items to a newer section of the clothing operation called UpSmart. Julia Martin started as the e-commerce sales manager for St. Vinny's a few years ago, and she runs this program.
I noticed just how much stuff that I thought had value for the company, and so I started getting into all the distressed stuff.
Martin ran a clothing resale business on eBay for 20 years, so she's got a good eye for pieces that can be re-envisioned rather than thrown away.
We're looking for stuff that's cool, interesting, that especially young people are very interested in wearing. We're also looking for specific genres of clothing.
The program is thriving. Martin projects her UpSmart and online sales will make $1 million this year.
We've managed to keep a lot of clothing out of the baler.
The baler. It's the final stop for clothing on this recycling journey. It's stuff that could not be sold, as hard as they tried. Discarded clothes are compacted into 1,500-pound bales, just like hay. St. Vinny says it has domestic and foreign buyers who still find use for these clothes. The organization insists it's conscious of where the bales end up, working to prevent items from becoming litter in other parts of the world. Still, they say, there are always unknowns. Well, one thing is for certain. A lot of the clothes being baled in Eugene are flimsy fast fashion items. Martin hopes the next generation will change that.
Young people today are really open to thrifting. They love that things are unique and interesting and not fast fashion.
Shoppers can discover their own brand of fashion at St. Vinny's thrift stores in Eugene and Springfield and around the state, from the Dalles to Cottage Grove, Florence to Oak Ridge. I'm Tiffany Eckert reporting.
In just over a year, planners say a new museum celebrating Oregon's film history will open to the public in Cottage Grove. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In the lobby of Cottage Grove City Hall, Catherine Wilson trembles as a finance clerk hands her and her husband Philip a $15,000 check.
Let's pull it out of the envelope for you.
Thank you very much.
The money from the Woodard Family Foundation will launch a 24-year dream for Wilson, a movie museum. She shares its timeline.
Building the 6 Animal House bedroom sets in the basement of the Armory. Got 14 months to get it all built and set decorated.
Partner Kurt Lidke is with the nonprofit Oregon Arts and Film. He says Cottage Grove has been an epicenter for filmmaking for years.
Going back to the silent film era and the much celebrated Buster Keaton film, The General, through films like Stand By Me and, of course, Animal House.
City manager Mike Sauerwein says the movie museum should be a huge draw for tourists. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Cottage Grove.
You're listening to news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Tiny pocket forests are sprouting up all around Washington State, on old abandoned fields and in people's backyards. These forests are meant to mimic nature and to grow quickly. It also helps increase biodiversity. NWPB's Courtney Flatt takes us to one of the Yakima Nation's mini forests.
This hot, wind-blown field used to be completely barren.
There was nothing out here at all. They didn't have to put weed killer on her because there was just nothing, no base to grow on. It was just dirt and a few rocks.
That's Mary Lee Jones. She's a gatherer with the Yakima Nation, and she helped transform this space into a mini forest more than 6 years ago. In the summertime, the forest cools this small space. It won't be enough to cool larger areas, but a little shade still helps. Summer temperatures here will only get hotter with climate change. Deborah Bird is a vice chairwoman for the Yakima Nation General Council.
So it's like 10 to 20 degrees cooler inside here. So you can come and sit and have lunch. It's really nice.
Bird is something of a mini forest evangelist. She even has one in her backyard. The Yakima Nation has planted several of these forests across its lands. Bird says the tribe is also considering expanding at least one of its mini forests. They've planted this forest in a very specific way. It's called the Miyawaki Method. It was the brainchild of Japanese botanist Akira Miyawaki.
He was creating these native forests that were growing 10 times faster than through typical afforestation.
That's Ethan Bryson. He knows the method well and planned out this forest. This style of planting has sprouted up all over the world, from New Zealand to South Africa.
Microforests, mini forests, pocket forests. I've even heard someone say petite forest.
They can grow in an area as small as 6 parked cars. Each plant only a forearm's length from the other. A diverse array of shrubs, ground cover, and trees stratify the canopy layers, all plants native to the area. At first, Bird says it was hard to find so many native plants. The forest has at least 47 different species and almost 9,000 trees.
There's only a few nurseries in the whole state that grow these plants, so we did have to get from several different areas. And we had to coordinate a time to get them here.
They've dubbed it the Healing Forest. Now, aspens and cottonwood trees sway back and forth. Wild roses and elderberry bushes peek out of the densely packed foliage. Jones shows everything off.
Shall we go inside?
Inside, paths circle the edges of the small forest. Jones points out all sorts of plants that would have grown here 200 years ago.
The currants, the little yellow blossoms, we call them chun and chunan.
The whole thing forms the shape of a medicine wheel. Each path acts as a spoke, leading to an empty hub in the center. Yakima Nation member Marlene Hunt says some people were skeptical at first. Then they noticed.
If you go out into the wild, you can see the trees the same way. And that's kind of mimicking what Mother Nature has already done.
When they went into the ground, these native plants were just saplings. She pinches her fingers close together to show just how small. And now, she raises her hands as high as she can reach.
Those first 3 years, everything flourished so much. You see all the mushrooms growing wild out here. You see the animals, some of them, you see them running away as soon as they see you coming.
Many plants in this arid forest can also be used for teas, tinctures, and other important cultural uses for the tribe. Bird says these mini forests help people experience nature, not too far from home.
I think it's like a gem in the Yakima Nation.
And Joan says there's still much to learn from these tiny forests.
Nature will truly give us the insight of teaching if we listen, to understand how diversity makes up a community.
I'm Courtney Flatt in Toppenish, Washington.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. President Donald Trump's executive order to verify the citizenship eligibility of registering and mail-in voters was dealt a serious blow by a federal district court June 22nd. It ruled that the integration of Social Security and other federal data into the SAVE database violated federal privacy statutes. Trump's March 31st order spurred multiple lawsuits by voters, states, pro-democracy groups, and civil rights advocates, arguing it violates the U.S. Constitution's Elections Clause and state and federal privacy statutes. In this case, by the League of Women Voters and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, plaintiffs argue that the inclusion of Social Security and other federal data in the SAVE database violated the privacy protections in the Social Security Act, the Privacy Act of 1974, and the Administrative Procedures Act. The judge agreed, bluntly writing, having flunked compliance with the Social Security Act, the Privacy Act, and the APA, the defendants looked to other statutes to justify the establishment of the modified SAVE system, unquote. DHS argued provisions in two immigration control statutes authorized use of the data, to which the judge wrote, "This argument is not a winner either. It may be appealed, and multiple other cases are pending, including a challenge by 23 state attorneys general." We've linked the 75-page decision at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.